Florida lawmakers have just 1 week left before the final gavel is due to fall, calling an end to this law writing session. I'm Tom Hudson. We begin a week of special programs examining this legislative season. It's the Sunshine Edition, Session 2014. Lawmakers have more than $1 billion extra dollars this year, a surplus thanks to the state's recovering economy. How will they spend them? On whom? And for what? Many of those decisions happen not on the floor of the House or Senate, but in the hallways and offices of the Capitol. And Florida may have no state personal income tax and plenty of sunshine, but is that really enough for the Sunshine State and its economy to remain competitive, growing, and attracting good-paying and stable jobs? It's all ahead on a WLRN special, Sunshine Edition, Session 2014. This is a WLRN special, Sunshine Edition, Session 2014. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. For 2 months each year, 160 men and women elected by Florida voters gather in Tallahassee to make state policy. This year's lawmaking session is scheduled to end Friday, this week. So all this week here on WLRN, at this hour, we will be reporting on and examining what Florida lawmakers have accomplished, what's been ignored, and how it will affect you. Coming up in the hour here ahead, the race to complete a $75 billion state budget. We will take you off the chamber floor and behind the scenes where lawmakers listen and lobbyists lobby. And we may have the sunshine and no personal state income tax, but is Florida staying competitive? All that ahead on a Sunshine Edition Session 2014 special here from WLRN. This is the Sunshine Edition, Session 2014 here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Florida lawmakers may be debating reforms to child welfare laws, medical marijuana, even firing warning shots in self-defense. But the mandatory business lawmakers have to accomplish before the final gavel falls, due on Friday, is to approve a state budget. The spending plan takes effect in July, and the clock is ticking today. They have until tomorrow to put the blueprint together in order for lawmakers to have the required 3 days to consider it and then vote on it on Friday before they go home. Here's the big picture right now for the Florida state budget. About $75 billion, a record amount of spending. 17 cents on the dollar earmarked for K-12 public education in the Sunshine State, and more than $1 billion in extra money, a surplus thanks to rising sales taxes driven by an improving state economy, especially the booming tourist trade. Dollars, especially tax dollars, are all about decisions, and those decisions are being made over the next following hours by two of the Florida lawmakers joining us now here on the Sunshine Edition. Representative Katie Edwards, a Democrat from Plantation, and Representative Jose Felix Diaz, a Republican from Miami. Representatives, welcome to the program, and welcome to the final week of lawmaking. Representative Diaz, let's begin with you and the majority party. Budget talks have been relatively quiet. Is a battle looming over the next 48 hours or so?
Well, the next 48 hours are of vital importance. The biggest things right now are some items in the agriculture budget and in the education budget. But other than that, we've come to terms on most everything, and those final battles are being decided between the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate.
Yeah, definitely taking part on the leadership side. Representative Edwards in the minority party and the Democrats, are you satisfied with the way the budget stands right now here in the final hours before the document will be printed and land on your desk?
We've made some significant progress, especially last night was very exciting for us to see that we're finally getting about $82 million in funding for environmental projects, mainly for Everglades restoration, and also to address projects in the Indian River Lagoon and our areas down south to finish up comprehensive Everglades restoration projects. One sticking point that does remain, though, between the House and the Senate as we continue to negotiate our offers, the House is offering a 5% across-the-board raise for state law enforcement employees, and those would also include our highway patrol officers and special agents. So we're finishing to negotiate back and forth and work out some final details there, but I agree with my colleague, Representative Diaz. We are getting closer to reaching a resolution and hopefully have something we can all vote on Friday.
Representative Diaz, a 5% across-the-board increase for law enforcement in the state of Florida. Do you think that's going to get through the Senate?
Hopefully. I mean, I know that we had similar talks yesterday about increases for public defenders and state attorneys in our criminal justice system, and we we're able to agree to an across the board increase for them.
How much do how much are they in line for?
$3,000 per employee, which is a significant amount and something that they've been waiting for a long time.
So there you went for a hard dollar amount as opposed to a percentage increase. What was the reasoning there versus the 5% that the House is asking the Senate to approve for law enforcement pay raises?
It was just a request that came to us from the public defender and state attorneys. I think it amounts to about a 3% raise to their total budget, is that $3,000 figure.
Representative Edwards, you mentioned some of the environmental issues, and I'll tackle those in a moment, but education is a significant line item in the state budget, as it is every year, close to $11 billion this year, 17 cents on the dollar earmarked for K-12 public education. Are you satisfied that the amount of money that is in the proposed budget is going to satisfy the needs and demands of public school kids in the state of Florida?
Well, I think one of the arguments we can have is that there can never be enough money invested in public education, but we were able to work out our K-12 education budget. That was settled last week. The one thing that the House and Senate continue to negotiate, though, are the penalties for the school districts that don't meet that constitutional mandate for the limits on classroom size. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the budget. We're also looking at, you know, how we're going to penalize these school districts that aren't able to meet that constitutional mandate for the classroom size. The one thing that's been very important this year, though, that we haven't had in several years, are funds for public education capital outlay, or these PICO funds. And we're still working on ways that we can get money to these education projects. I mean, we have some facilities, especially in South Florida, that are in dire need of repair. And we haven't had these dollars in many years to be able to make those necessary improvements and upgrades to labs, to dormitories, and to our teaching facilities. So we're trying to be able to get those dollars to our facilities there across the state.
Representative Katie Edwards, a Democrat from Plantation, Jose Felix Diaz, a representative from Miami, both Florida State representatives here on the Sunshine Edition on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Representative Diaz, let me ask you about education funding. The Miami-Dade County Superintendent Alberto Carvalho has been very vocal over the past couple of weeks about tightening up property tax appeals processes to reduce the time and require homeowners to approve of an appeal filed on their behalf. His contention is that the delays in the appeals and allowing homeowner property tax appeals to go forward without the homeowner necessarily knowing about them has cost his school district millions upon millions of dollars. Is this loophole going to be tightened up? Is it going to be closed before Friday?
Well, we actually passed a bill a couple years ago to try to fix that already, and there's another bill that should tighten it further in the process. But we do have good news for him.
Mm-hmm.
We have been working on some conforming language in our bill to actually bridge the gap and get him whole for this year. It's something that was a top priority for the school board and something the Senate's offered, and hopefully the House is in the process of accepting. So when tomorrow's done, I think the Miami-Dade School Board is going to be very happy.
Give us a little bit more details there, Representative Diaz, joining us from Skype from Tallahassee, so a little bit echoey here. But Representative, what are some of the details that the House has put in front of it to make the Miami-Dade County Public School System whole in terms of missing the millions of dollars that that are subject to the homeowner's property tax appeal process?
Well, the school board had come up with a proposal, which we are in the process of incorporating into the budget, which would give them additional flexibility in their millage rate, and it would give them the ability to transfer funds that they currently don't have access to cover the $40 to $60 million gap of funding because of that value adjustment board glitch. That gets them through next year, when hopefully the new law, which will allow school boards to get additional funding to cover the gap, comes into play. So it's a one-year fix to get them through the permanent fix, which should be also on the books.
Representative Edwards, you in support of this fix?
I think so. I mean, it makes sense from a homeowner standpoint, too. You want to be able to file your appeal and not have to wait months, even in excess of a year, to be able to settle your tax bill and know what you actually owe. So I'm fully supportive of making that process as quick as we can so we can settle our tax rolls and get the school board the funds that they need.
One of the first pieces of business that the Florida legislature, both houses, were successful in approving, and Governor Scott has already signed, is $400 million in tax cuts as represented by lower vehicle registration fees. The governor's proposal was $500 million in all in tax cuts by this session. So very close, Representative Diaz. Are you going to be able to cross that? Are you going to be able to give the governor that full $500 million in tax cuts?
I think so, and the final numbers are still being negotiated. We in the Day delegation are still hopeful that some of those dollars will go to some of the tax credit programs that we have for film. The Tax and Finance Committee has been working on the package the whole year, and we will be at or around $500 million in tax cuts, which will keep the governor's office very happy.
So, Representative Edwards, let me ask you about this in regards to the tax cuts, in regards to the budget surplus that we know that you and your colleagues are handling here, certainly. We also know, thanks to the Miami Herald investigation, Innocence Lost, about the hundreds upon hundreds of children who had contact with child welfare authorities who've died in the past 6 years. And the governor's also talked about additional funding for the Department of Children and Families. There's lots of projects, certainly, that you folks are going to take a look at over the next 48 hours, the next 72, 96 hours ahead of Friday. Give us your estimation, Representative Edwards, of finding that balance between new discretionary spending that's going to go after, in this case, child welfare, versus more hometown projects that local areas could benefit from, like Representative Diaz talks about in terms of the film credits, for instance.
I think, our primary focus needs to be on job creation. So first and foremost, wanting to make sure that we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck and that we can get those state funds and those tax credits to businesses that employ Floridians, are going to make the investment, that are going to stay here and help us stretch those dollars as far as we can. And in addition to that, trying to make sure that we can shore up the areas in our budget that have been historically cut for so long. You mentioned the issues with DCF, the number of cases that we have seen in the papers dealing with children who are abused and neglected. And I think we're trying to strike a balance when it comes to our priorities. That's one of my biggest disappointments. I think that we can be doing a better job to shore up the DCF budget, to put more social workers out there, to provide better resources to parents and their caregivers, and also provide the resources that we need to stop these instances of abuse and neglect. So that's a sticking point for Democrats, is trying to focus on these unmet needs. I do applaud our efforts so far to get individuals off of our Agency for Persons with Disabilities waiting list. The number of calls that we get to our office for individuals who have extreme medical disabilities that really, truly do need help, we want to make sure that those individuals are off the waiting list. In a year that we have a budget surplus, we should have nobody on the waiting list. So it's a step forward, but still, we're not quite there yet in helping our most vulnerable, weakest members of our Florida population.
Representative Diaz, respond to that, finding the balance between job growth, economic growth, and protecting the most vulnerable Florida population. Skyrise Miami, for instance, has become kind of a lightning rod, figuratively, despite the fact that it's a proposed 1,000-foot observation tower that is planned for downtown Miami, as a development that has some state funding behind it, at least proposed, balanced against the vulnerability of certain populations here in the state of Florida that have seen state funding cut over the past several years.
Well, most of those groups that have been cut have been restored little by little in the budget the last couple of years when the budget has come back on track. And, unfortunately, I think that it's a false choice to say that you can't fund child protective investigators and still continue to fund some of the local projects, which include things like cancer research for Sylvester Hospital and for Jackson Memorial Hospital. It includes funding for the League Against Cancer. It includes funding for autism programs. So it is a delicate balance, but that's the biggest part of our job as legislators. We have to balance a $75 billion budget. In 1952, the federal government had a budget less than the state budget of Florida has today. So it is a tall task. It's something that we take very seriously, and I'm very proud of what we've come to. We've put more money into affordable housing than we have in the last 4 years. We put more money into education than we ever have. We put more money into Medicaid than we ever have. There's a lot of good stuff in this budget, and I'm really happy with the stuff that we've done for the Department of Children and Families. That's one of my most important issues, and I really do think that we're going to save a lot of lives with the additional investment into child abuse investigations and into proper training for the child abuse investigators.
Final documents are due on your desks by Tuesday. You'll likely vote on it by Friday. Jose Felix Diaz, Representative Republican from Miami. Katie Edwards, a Democrat representative from Plantation. Thank you to both of you for joining us here on the Sunshine Edition. Still to come on our program in the final week of lawmaking, the deal making is fast and furious, lobbying and the legislative process. This is the Sunshine Edition, session 2014 here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. You can follow along a live discussion online right now at WLRN.org. Tweet us using the handle at WLRN, the hashtag Sunshine Edition. With $1 billion surplus and a $75 billion budget in play this week for Florida lawmakers, lobbyists are in high gear at the Capitol for this final week of the legislative session. These point people for special interests explain, persuade, coax, and cajole regulators and legislators to see issues the way their clients do. It is part of the process. WLRN Miami Herald reporter Gina Jordan takes us behind the scenes with one longtime lobbyist.
Hello, hello. Good morning, Rep. How are you, sir?
Jack Corey doesn't stop moving much during the session. He knows every senator, every representative, and their staffs. Corey's clients include the Florida and National Greyhound Associations. He recently testified before senators about a bill that would require dog tracks to report greyhound injuries and deaths.
I will continue, as I have told Senator Sobel, to talk to other members of the Senate and members of the House on stopping injuries now, not waiting for reporting later. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Corey.
Corey has spent decades in Florida politics. He started this day with four shots of espresso before dawn.
Lobbying is not brown bags and martini lunches. My day starts at 5 a.m. in the morning on most days. It very seldom ends before 10 o'clock or midnight. We will be in Saturday and Sundays during the last weeks of the session trying to get appropriations. And these are not appropriations necessarily for special interest. We represent the Boys and Girls Clubs. We obviously also represent some business clients, too.
Corey sees himself as an educator, teaching lawmakers about the changes his clients are seeking. His typical day during session involves lots of committee meetings and individual meetings with legislators. He's armed with one-page documents containing bullet points of information. They come in handy when he runs into lawmakers like Miami Democratic Representative Keone McGee.
This is for your Boys and Girls Club down in Miami. This bill will be up next week.
I'm so glad to run.
Appreciate you. Thank you very much, Rep.
Corey was part of a boys club as a teenager up north, where he learned how to be a radio broadcaster. He spent time in the Air Force, worked in marketing, and eventually started running political campaigns. Corey sat down for a chat before another long day of lobbying at the Capitol. He says most lobbyists are ethical, and he's really annoyed by the law that bans lobbyists from giving gifts to legislators or even buying them a cup of coffee.
People like to perceive that we only represent special interests. I have to speak a lot to college students and other youth groups that come to the Capitol, and the first thing I ask them is the profession of their parents and whether their parents are a nurse, a doctor, a banker, a realtor. I bring to their attention that each one of their parents employs a lobbyist, and they have a lobbyist in the Capitol, and I tell them where their offices are. So once they realize that every one of their families are being touched by somebody who is representing their family before the state legislature, they realize it's not quite as sinister.
Certainly there are people who think that lobbying is about making backroom deals. What does the law say you can do?
We have some state statutes that require honesty, ethics, require registration, require full disclosure of your clients, require factual testimony, require honesty. And we do all of those things. And if you don't, you don't survive around here very long.
Why do companies or organizations need to have a lobbyist?
They need to have one so that their views are put forth before the legislature and so that they can stay at home taking care of their business. Now, that does not mean that those folks back home don't have to be involved in their public affairs program. They have to participate 52 weeks a year in doing their grassroots back home.
Are there any laws you think could be changed to help make your job easier?
Well, the gift law is obviously probably one of the silliest things the legislature ever did to itself. Term limits is equally as silly. We certainly wouldn't tell doctors or bankers or brain surgeons that you could only serve for 8 years. And after you've been a brain surgeon for 8 years, you have to go find a new job. But yet that's what we tell our public officials in Florida. Once you get the experience and the knowledge of the process, and this is a very complicated process, to have a citizen legislature, a part-time legislature, it's very, very difficult. And term limits is the bane of the productiveness of the legislature. The gift law just broke the camaraderie of members being able to break bread with each other, to make it some sort of a sinister thing that a not-for-profit cannot take their legislator out for dinner and sit down and try to talk to them about their issues is just silliness. Nobody who is honest, moral, legal, and ethical is going to sell their soul for a meal.
Jack Corey runs public affairs consultants in Tallahassee with his wife, Kina. He's been lobbying the Florida legislature for more than 20 years. I'm Gina Jordan in Tallahassee.
Among those crowding the hallways in Tallahassee this week also include Ron Book, a veteran lobbyist based here in South Florida, busy at work in the capital city this week. Ron, welcome to the program. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Dan Krasner also joining us from Tallahassee, co-founder and executive director of Integrity Florida, a government watchdog group. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Ron, you've represented school districts, the Dolphins, taxi drivers, Greyhound racetracks, AT&T, Auto Nation, Fort Lauderdale, the city of Doral, Hallandale Beach, the city of Palm Bay, of Riviera Beach, Sunny Isles Beach, Miramar Marathon. The list goes on. You are certainly one of the most hardest working lobbyists, most successful, arguably, lobbyists in the state of Florida. Where's the line?
Well, the line's pretty clear, but let me just also add that one of the last projects you spoke to Representative Diaz and Representative Edwards about was the Skyrise project, which I claim is mine as well. Mm-hmm. I think the lines are pretty clear. I think that while I did not believe there was a problem when the Lobbyist Reform Act passed a number of years ago, and I felt strongly enough about it that I took an appeal of it to the United States Supreme Court, it didn't mean that some aspects of the Reform Act weren't good. I think there were. I think there were others that were intrusions that went above and beyond what were necessary. I think there's a necessary function for people that do what I do. I think if you simply rely on legislative staff to provide all of the information and input to lawmakers, they will have one point of view, one set of views, and no other balance to what they hear and what they're able to act on from an informational perspective. I think we provide a necessary function. I think if you were to do without lobbyists that do what I do and some of my colleagues do, the process would be a poorer process as a result of it. But I think there are clear lines of what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do, and we do our best to make sure we don't get anywhere close to the line.
So more than just toe the line, you want to stay well far away from that line. Dan Krasner, do you agree that the line is clear in the state of Florida?
Well, the line is not clear in the country. We need to have a national conversation about the definition of corruption, because if we listen to the U.S. Supreme Court and the McCutcheon decision, only quid pro quo bribery is corruption anymore that we need to pay attention to, and that's ridiculous.
Well, your group in 2012 called Florida the worst for public corruption. Why was that? What was the metric you used?
Well, several. Between the years 2000 and 2010, Florida had more federal public corruption convictions than any other state in the country. Also, an international and national effort at stateintegrity.org that WLRN and PRI were mm-hmm. part of promoting gave Florida a failing grade for our ethics enforcement agencies. So we, you know, we're catching the criminals, but we what's legal and what's under our state and local ethics codes, we're doing a very poor job of handling in our state.
Dan, let me ask you this. I mean, does lobbying lead to corruption in your mind? Is it that simple?
Well, lobbying is a constitutionally protected
right.
act, and,
mm-hmm.
and we need lobbyists. We need people who are knowledgeable on the issues, like Ron Book, to be up here and educating our lawmakers on policy. But you know, there's some legitimate questions that we need to be asking ourselves. You know, should politicians and actually, you know, it's what's legal that's the problem. We have basically legalized extortion where politicians are upping the amount of money they ask for from lobbyists and their clients every year. That's a growing problem that needs to be reined in.
Ron, let me just pause right there, Dan, and have Ron respond to that. Legalized extortion. Ron Book, veteran lobbyist in Florida. Your response.
Well, I don't look at it as legalized extortion. I would simply say the following. Anybody that wants to bring additional campaign finance reform measures to the legislature, we generally support. I support almost anything that provides transparency and provides a greater level of disclosure of what we give and where it came from. And I'm an individual who had an issue as to where it came from in my past, made a mistake in that regard. I think that things that restore public confidence in the system are positive. That said, you know, I don't believe in quid pro quos, and I don't believe that you give to get. I believe that that those who give probably get their phone calls returned a little quicker. I think they probably get an appointment a little quicker. I don't know that it buys them a vote on anything. As it relates to the issue of whether or not we're the most corrupt state in the country, I would simply say to the following. I think our prosecutors do a better job than others. I think that our ethics reform laws are create a platform for which lots of things come to the attention of our prosecutorial and policing entities. And I think that as a result of that, we have more of it that's found than other places in the country. I don't think that we're some hotbed for political corruption that doesn't exist in other places in the country.
Ron Book, veteran lobbyist based in South Florida, joining us from Tallahassee, alongside Dan Krasner, co-founder and executive director of Integrity Florida. Dan, you talked about campaign spending, campaign funding. The 2013 Florida State Legislature approved reform, signed into law, that limited individuals to $3,000 donations for statewide offices, other candidates at $1,000. Is this reform early in the game, but is this reform effective?
That one's moving in the right direction. I mean, corruption doesn't like sunlight, and disclosure is the key to accountability. The campaign finance law from last year and the ethics law, increased disclosure, increased transparency, you know, are trying to shift responsibility and accountability for money in politics to the candidates themselves, which it's not there now. I mean, right now we have a broken campaign finance system. The political parties on both sides of the aisle are allowed to take unlimited checks. So that's where the big money goes. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the PACs. Unlimited money.
Political
action committees. So the candidates themselves and their accounts and their campaigns are becoming irrelevant. You look at the special congressional elections we've had in the last year in Florida. The candidates have lost all control. Outside interests from outside the districts are coming in with unlimited funds and taking over our campaigns. So, we've lost the link between the public officials and the public interest and the people they represent.
Dan, the supporters of that will argue that dollars are free speech. The amount of money that can be spent is a First Amendment issue. Political speech cannot be restrained. And at least the United States Supreme Court, in its most recent series of decisions, has seemed to agree with that position.
So the next presidential debate, maybe the candidate who bribes the TV station the most with the most money and advertising will get more time in the debate.
Now, Dan, do you mean buying advertising time, equating that to a bribery?
Well, I'm saying if money is speech, then you know, why have equal time in debates anymore? You know, just let the candidate with the most money control the most amount of time.
Ron Book, is money speech in Tallahassee this week?
I think it's a longer discussion than we probably have time to do today. I would simply say the following. The courts have spoken on the issue of what you can and what you can't do as far as giving. I think that the place where there's probably some level and room for improvement is what you can use the monies for that are given to political action committees and formerly the 527, the ECOs and the which are election campaign organizations, mm-hmm. and the CCEs, which are committees of continuing existence. Those are the acronyms. I think that to say that you can only give an elected official a $500 donation, or now $1,000, or $1,000, which is now $3,000, depending on whether it's a state, local, or statewide race, or a congressional race, but then you can turn around and write a check for $25,000 or $50,000 to a political action committee and use those funds to fund almost anything that you want. I think that's probably an area that, that could use some level of attention. I think the unlimited contributions to the political action committee, so long as it is used in the furtherance of your election to public office, is one thing. But I think those who have, in many instances, used it to live on, I think that's where there's a line for some opportunity for additional change.
Dan Krasner, co-founder and executive director of Integrity Florida. Dan, let me ask you, in the final waning days here of the Florida legislative 2014 session, if you and Ron both call the same state legislator, whose phone call gets returned first, do you think?
Well, I'm not a lobbyist, so I wouldn't be calling a legislator directly, but I guarantee you they're going to answer Ron's call. He's very effective at what he does.
Ron Book, veteran lobbyist, do you agree with that assessment?
Probably.
Ron Book.
Let's put it this way, I hope so.
Ron Book, a veteran lobbyist based in South Florida, with us from Tallahassee. Dan Krasner, co-founder, executive director of Integrity Florida. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us here on WLRN and the Sunshine Edition. Lobbyists may ply their work for paying clients, but to some degree, all voters really work to shape the opinion of those elected to represent us, don't we? We do it on election day. Maybe we do it by phone. We call the office, or we email a legislator, or we attend in person a public meeting. So how have you worked to influence elected officials? We put that to our Public Insight Network. Annette Alvarez of Miami says she connects with her representative over social media.
I am Facebook friends with my former representative on the state level, and he sends out queries to constituents gathering opinions. So actually, I've chimed in on a couple of things, and one of them was medical marijuana. And I think it's a really refreshing way for him to hear from a wide assortment of people as to what they're thinking and what's going on.
Connecting in the 21st century with your legislators over social media, Betty King of Miami Beach was a bit more disappointed, though, in her attempt to change the mind of her local representative.
I volunteered many hours on her campaign and had contacted her during the campaign about her stance on historic preservation issues. She reassured me that she was a solid preservationist. Then on her very first and a subsequent vote, she has voted to weaken preservation provisions.
Still to come on our program here, Sunshine Edition, session 2014, Florida's tourism business may be booming. There's no state personal income tax and all the sunshine you can soak up here in the state of Florida. But is that enough to attract good-paying, steady jobs? A WLRN special during this final week of the Florida legislative session. I'm Tom Hudson.
Nobody does it better. Hertz leads the others by far. Nobody does it best of all you.
Little nostalgia there. Hertz car rental from 1978. Now fast forward 35 years, and the vehicle rental company now calls Florida home. 5 months ago, Hertz broke ground on its new global headquarters. Thousands of people pick up their keys from Hertz or one of their other car rental brands each and every day. But the new headquarters is not in New York, New Jersey, or Los Angeles. It's just north of Naples. Hertz is expected to bring about 400 jobs to Southwest Florida. It's a high-profile prize in the battle for business, jobs, and tax revenue. Governor Scott boasts of eliminating 3,000 regulations and creating thousands of jobs in the Sunshine State. A record number of Floridians are working today thanks to the rebound in tourism, but is that enough to keep Florida competitive? Victor Mendelson is co-president of HICO. Welcome, Victor, back to WLRN. Jane Wooldridge, business editor for the Miami Herald, and Mark Vittner, senior economist at Wells Fargo. Jane and Mark, also welcome to the program. Mark, let's begin with you. You're looking not only at Florida, but looking at the entire United States. Florida's unemployment rate is below the national rate. The state's economy is growing. The population is growing. No personal state income tax. Plenty of sunshine. Plenty of sand. How strong has the recovery in Florida been compared to other states?
Well, it's been one of the strongest recoveries that we've seen across the country, and some of that is because we fell so hard during the recession. And so a lot of the strength that we're seeing in job growth recently has been a bounce back from those very low levels. And some of the areas that fell the hardest, like construction, are the very ones that are coming back the fastest.
Victor, HEICO is a global company. You've got significant operations here in South Florida. What's your view of the Florida economy?
Overall, I think it's pretty strong. It's been healthy. Florida, overall, is a great place to do business. I mean, there are many Floridas, and our company has 8 operations where we produce products or services in the state. And, in fact, we recently relocated a business from Illinois down to the Sarasota area because we find that people are happy here and they want to work hard.
I relocated from Illinois myself about 4.5 years ago. You don't have to shovel humidity, as Jane Wooldridge from the Miami Herald knows very, very well. The historic economic opportunities of Florida, again, the no-income tax and the weather and the lifestyle, is that enough any longer?
Well, it's a good question. As we've seen a lot of young Floridians move out of the marketplace looking for opportunity elsewhere, I think part of that is a natural response to wanting to see the world beyond where you grew up. But some of the issues have been that we have fairly low wages here. And when this was a really cheap place to live, well, that was fine. When I moved here, we're not going to talk about how many years ago, but when I came here a very long time ago, this was an inexpensive place to live comparative to other places in the world. Now, if you're talking about comparison to Silicon Valley, to LA, to New York, it's still a bargain. But if you're talking about comparison to a place like Raleigh, North Carolina, things here have gotten very expensive in relationship to the cost of living. Mm-hmm. So we're now one of the most expensive places in the country to rent a place to live in relationship to median income, and that's an issue.
Victor, have you seen that as you've relocated one of your business operations from Illinois, traditionally thought of as a high cost place to do business because of taxes and regulations, into Florida in terms of the cost of living that your employees are going to encounter?
We certainly see it in South Florida. It is very pronounced in Dade County in particular, and we see it also fairly pronounced in Broward County. As we move away from the Dade-Broward area, it's less noticeable. Mm. And so where we have relocated, for example, where Hertz is going to be going, and we have our operations in the Sarasota area, it's still much more affordable than a lot of other venues.
Mark Vittner, senior economist with Wells Fargo, you were educated in Florida. You know this economy in this state well. Talk to that point that Victor Mendelson of HEICO points out, the varying cost of living issues throughout the state of Florida, South Florida versus perhaps the rest of the state. Is it a disadvantage in South Florida?
It is. It's not as much of an advantage as it used to be. And one of the things that we miss from all this is how much variation there is in housing cost. And affordable housing is a big issue in Dade County in particular, and in a good part of Broward County. But more and more options are available. So when you get beyond Fort Lauderdale and Miami, there's a pretty good mix of housing options in the rest of the state. So I think the state is still a very affordable location. The state's also made a concerted effort to attract more higher paying jobs, and it's very hard to make a measurable impact when you have such a large tourism sector. And one of the things that we've done is that we've looked at growth excluding tourism. So if you took tourism out of Florida, how does job growth stand out?
What have you found?
Florida's still adding jobs at a faster rate than the rest of the country. Even Orlando, which has the largest share of its economy in the tourist sector of any metro area in the state, has stronger job growth outside of the tourist sector than the nation does. They're growing at a 2.8% annual rate, where U.S. job growth is 1.7%.
Mark, what have you identified as the contributing factors to that?
Some of that has been the efforts that local leaders have put into attracting a different mix of industries and trying to recruit the life sciences industry. The Medical City Complex in Central Florida has been fairly successful so far, and I think it's got a lot more success ahead of it. Also, in recruiting a different mix of employers to the region, the housing boom and bust really distorted a lot of the advantages that Florida has long held, and that when home prices ran up relative to the rest of the country, suddenly homes in Florida were selling at a premium relative to the rest of the country. That's not really the case for the state as a whole. It is for some selected markets.
Jane Wooldridge with the Miami Herald. We've seen that diversification effort, certainly here in South Florida. The technology industry is the one that does get a lot of attention, but there's even in aviation, even to some degree in manufacturing, and perhaps more the nuanced areas within tourism or the higher value areas within tourism.
Well, I think one of the things we forget in this equation is that part of what is now driving both tourism and people to relocate here, both in terms of personal relocation and business, is a growing cultural life here. Mm. And that tends to come with a little bit higher price tag than, you know, pure some other kinds of lifestyle. Personally, you know, I'm very happy to live in a culturally rich city like Miami. And so what that helps us to draw, for instance, is there's an effort, as you know, to bring in hedge fund companies. Mm-hmm. Those aren't tons of jobs, but those are very, very high-paying jobs. You don't get that without the kind of cultural life we're talking about.
And we've seen that in technology and other advanced sciences where the headcount isn't necessarily large, but the payroll certainly can be large. We're going to continue our conversation with Mark Vittner with Wells Fargo, Victor Mendelson with HEICO, Jane Wooldridge from the Miami Herald. Still to come, with the state ready to spend $11 billion on education, how does Florida's workforce stack up in the global race for jobs and growth? This is the Sunshine Edition, session 2014 here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. It's estimated almost 3 million new college degrees will be needed in Florida to meet the workforce demand in the next decade. But Florida's high school graduation rate is in the lowest third of all states. The competitiveness of the state is at stake. Victor Mendelson, co-president of HEICO, Mark Vittner, senior economist at Wells Fargo, and Jane Wooldridge, business editor with the Miami Herald, join us here on the Sunshine Edition. Victor, you have hundreds of Floridians working for HEICO throughout the state. What's your assessment? Does the Florida workforce stack up?
I think they stack up very well. We've had great success here in the state, and as we talked about earlier, we've added people, and I think we'll continue to do that. Where it does get a little bit challenging is on certain specific skills that are plentiful in, let's say, the Midwest, metalworking in particular, which are not so well developed here in our state, where there's more heavy production. Also, I think engineering in the state of Florida lags a little bit behind. It's a little harder to recruit people into the science, technology, engineering.
Mark, how about that? The qualities of an attractive workforce, the advanced engineering, the science, the technology, the engineering, the mathematics, the so-called STEM type of degrees. How's Florida stacking up?
Well, we're improving. We had been lagging for quite some time because the state's economy was so anchored toward tourism and international visitors And really, we had such an embarrassment of riches for so long that we didn't have to improve all the things that a lot of other areas had done in order to attract businesses. And that's changed. Work in general has become more capital intensive and involves more technology than it did in the past. A lot of that burden falls on the community colleges, and that's but also the universities. I mean, the universities, I think, have made fairly significant strides, and we are seeing that the number of college graduates in Florida is growing at a fairly strong pace.
But Jane, it starts with that K-12. It starts with that public education. It starts with that 17 cents on the dollar that Florida legislators are likely to spend on K-12 education in the budget cycle that they'll approve by Friday.
Well, certainly in Miami-Dade County, we've made huge, huge strides under Superintendent Carvalho, but it is an ongoing issue for the state of Florida. We have often not rated well in comparison to spending and in comparison to production, and it's not just the K-12, it's early childhood education. So every time we cut those funds, we're really hurting ourselves in the long run. it's always a balancing act. You know, where do you make your investments? And I think most of us philosophically agree that making investments in education is critical. But then how do you slice that against your other needs in a state?
Victor, any plans on adding headcount in Florida in the next year for HICO?
We do. We expect to add pretty much at most of our facilities in the state.
Hmm. Mark Vittner, that's got to be encouraging for the Florida economy to hear a major Fortune 500 employer saying they're going to add to headcount.
Well, it is, and we are seeing that more and more. Business confidence has been relatively slow to recover since the recession 5 years ago. But we're finally seeing where more businesses are planning to add staff this year than reduce it, really for the first time going all the way back to before the recession.
Mark Vittner, senior economist at Wells Fargo, Victor Mendelson, co-president at HICO, and Jane Wooldridge, business editor for the Miami Herald. Thank you to the three of you. Finally, here on our Sunshine Edition, while Florida works to diversify its economy and attract other industries, it's the sand, it's the surf, it's the sunshine, we know it, provided by our unique location here on the map that really remains the state's biggest economic advantage. So as we celebrate April as National Poetry Month, we ask listeners to meditate a bit on our geography and write a poem, including the words, "This is where." Eduardo Lis of Miami sent us this.
North Beach, Nobi. This is where I walked with nothing, unemployed, Walgreens bathing suit. Where I later splashed full of love and peaches. I go, it's there, no questions, no answers. Vast ocean, open winds, the roundness of the earth. I am just feet in the sand, I could be foam. The beach to be alone, breathe, to be together, laugh, to be in love, kiss, to dream with clenched fingers. The beach to bury your head in the sand or have the courage to do cartwheels.
Eduardo Lis of Miami. You can join us this Wednesday, for our This Is Where finale at Miami Club Rum at 6:30 p.m. You can read more at WLRN.org. Now, tomorrow on this program, Sunshine Edition, we'll hear why some parents from opposite ends of the political spectrum want their children to opt out of testing tied to Common Core. We will talk about education more on tomorrow's Sunshine Edition. This program is produced by Elaine Chen and the WLRN Miami Herald Newsroom. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Sound direction this morning by Paul Leary. And our theme music by Aaron Libos. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Edition. Thanks for listening.